You know, last week we started off, I think we started off talking about soul. I mean, we ended up talking about the three characteristics of all things. This is a list in the Buddha's system called the Tilakana. Ti means three. Lakana means marks or characteristics. It's like things are marked by these qualities. So things they carry the mark of these things. And the three marks or the three characteristics are dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, anicca or impermanence, and anatta or selflessness, not self. So the classical formulation of them essentially says we can notice that nothing remains the same, that everything changes ceaselessly. There's always flux. Everything is in process. Because of this, we can recognize, we can have the insight that no specific thing or being or experience can provide a permanent refuge, lasting happiness, permanent satisfaction, because it changes. You know, temporal happiness, temporally bound happiness can only really be found by connecting with an endless series of pleasant things, right? That's what most of us are going for, trying to make my life, you know, a relatively ongoing series of things I like. That's called happiness in the ordinary definition. And so dukkha says, you know, in terms of wanting something reliable and permanent, that's not going to work, right? You have to keep finding new things. And so things are marked by impermanence. They're marked by unsatisfactoriness, which really means impermanent satisfactoriness. And they're marked by selflessness, which means that because they change, they can't really be the basis of a stable identity, right? If I identify with the body, anxiety and fear are likely because the body is going to die. And so that means I might have the idea that my being or my identity is going to die. And that is terrifying for many folks. You know, if I identify with being, you know, middle class or healthy or young or able-bodied or living in a free society or any number of things that I might build a personality, an identity, a social group, you know, political leaning upon, all of those things are unreliable, right? They can change, and they do change. And so I can't base my identity on any of those, you know. And taken as a basis for insight, which is what their purpose is, they become a lens or a meditation, an inquiry through which we can explore our world, and particularly through which we can explore our habits of clinging. And when the Buddha defines dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, he defines it as five aspects of clinging. So dukkha or unsatisfactoriness is five aspects of clinging. And the five aspects are the khanda, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. It's a way of saying, if you really want to understand suffering, which is necessary if we want to be free from it, we want to change our patterns around clinging, we have to understand clinging. It says, notice how you cling to forms. Right? Forms means your own body. It means other people's bodies. It means objects. It means images that you see. Everything in the material world that generates attachment. Right? Other people's bodies that generate feelings of lust, our own bodies that generate feelings of craving for comfort, youth, health, well-being, all those things. Objects that generate greed and wanting, other objects that generate fear. All of this is clinging to form. Right? So really understanding the ways that we cling, and again, cling really means solidify ideas and identities and patterns of action, addictive patterns around things, objects, bodies, people. The second aspect of clinging is feelings, specifically the base level affects of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So how we cling, generate story, generate habits, solidify identities around what we find pleasant, what we find unpleasant, what we space out around. The third aspect of clinging is perceptions or labels, recognition of things. So the way that clinging really forms around objects, experiences, people, that we recognize we have ongoing contact with, right? We see somebody, we recognize them, we know them, we like them, clinging arises. We know them, we dislike them, clinging arises. You know, the way that the natural organismic process of recognition and labeling the things around us is inseparable from the painful habits of the heart that are called clinging here. The fourth of the aspects of clinging is awkwardly translated as mental formations or karmic formations. The Pali word is sankhara. The Sanskrit is samskara. And sankhara, I think, is really the heart of the matter in terms of clinging. Sankhara is all of the stories and the choices we make around things, the identities that we spin that come out as narratives. Sankhara is the whole construct that happens between direct sensory experience and the sense of self. In a way, the sense of self is a deep sankhara. All of those layers of who I am, what things mean, how things should be, what I want, what I don't want, how that weaves into my life story, personality, all of that is this fourth aspect of clinging, or sankhara. It's built on the basic material reality of forms. It's built on how we react to experiences through feeling. It's built on the fundamental kind of dualistic nature of recognition. I recognize things and people and have names for things and people. And then all of that gets spun together into these extraordinary stories of who I am and what things mean and what I want. And so that whole complex is stitched together by clinging, or the resultant experience of all of that is clinging. And then the fifth of the aspects is to sense consciousness itself. The way that just the basic wakefulness that's really the water that we swim in, being awake, being conscious, being self-conscious, that this itself in a way is the most fundamental object of clinging. And so recognizing this, there's this weave between, this is really the insight that practice is pointing to, is a weave between seeing the impermanence or the changeability of things and understanding what that means about our life in the world, about how we cling. And one of the things that's mysterious in practice is that this is meant to be intuitive. It's not something to figure out or believe the teacher about. Impermanence is to be perceived directly, and the implications of it are to be felt viscerally. And so the mechanism for perceiving impermanence directly is meditation. You can see it in non-meditative states all around. But because things are relatively stable and the mind is not relatively stable, it's easy to not notice that things are changing, right? I come up with an idea of what my relationship with a person is and means, and I can, that narrative can actually be louder than their actual actions. I can hold on to the idea of who someone is, even as they are constantly changing, and that can create some friction, you know, in a relationship. I could hold on to an idea of who I am, even though I keep changing. And this is true, of course, for objects, it's bodies, ideas. And so because things seem relatively stable, right? Like I wake up every morning, it still seems like me. It's hard to notice subtle change. And so we get deluded by the perception of permanence. This is one of the classic mistakes, is to perceive as permanent something that is not permanent, right? That's a mark of, that's ignorance or delusion. And so the instruction is to get very still. That stillness of body, and then if we can manage it, some amount of stillness of thought, these are the conditions through which we can see change happening in a more, and feel change happening in a more visceral way. Right? There's, you know, it's almost like, you know, if I'm in a moving car, and you know, the scenery around me is flying by, everything's sort of doing what it is, it's hard for me to actually measure how fast anything was going, or really observe what was traveling from here to there, if I'm also traveling, hurtling across the landscape. But if I stop, if I find a relatively stable place to observe from, I can see movement all around me, right? I can see movement because I'm stable. And I can, in a sense, measure that movement. Then the more still I am, the more movement I can see, right? And so meditation, in a way, we could reduce all of the techniques down in a certain way to something like get as still as possible. Now, that doesn't mean clamp down on the body, you know, try not to breathe or try not to fidget at all. It's stillness here. It doesn't actually mean sort of like, this is a little bit like the answer around infinite space. It doesn't, it's not a material proposition, like become like a rock. It's more of a state that we train ourselves toward, where the stillness is really stillness of intentional movement, right? It's mostly stillness of the mind is the main thing, but it's stillness of volitional movement. And so what I do is I see if I can turn down the volume on, or step out of the stream of, or just quiet down a little bit the constant rush of impulses and actions that are pouring through me. I'm always receiving new sensory information that can't be stopped. And then in response to that sensory information, there's this, you know, constant response of impulse. And you can feel it in a way that every sensory input generates a kind of impulse response. This is part of what happens with this second of the clinging aspects of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And some of you will recognize this as the sequence of dependent origination. What happens is there's sensory contact. Almost immediately, there's a reading of that contact as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And almost immediately on the heels of that is a response in the form of an impulse. And that impulse is usually some kind of motion, right? Sometimes it's just the motion of thought, right? I see something, it's pleasant or unpleasant, and there's a movement of judging that comes with a desire to move closer or away from, You know, I want more of that, I want less of that. So a little impulse. And even if I'm physically still, that mental impulse can be ordering the world around me. You know, it's ordering the world around me to things I like and dislike. And based in that, my choices are going to happen, right? I have a little ache in my hip and a movement impulse is going to come to work it out, right? I don't really like that sound. An impulse is going to come to pull my attention away from it, or actually try to make the sound quieter, or do something about it, or ignore, or complain. All of those things would be volitional actions arising out of impulse in response to that sensory input. And so stillness in meditation is a way of saying, figure out how to stop doing that for a while. And to do that, we need to accept sensory input and pleasant and unpleasant feeling as just natural arising, just flat the flowering of the ecosystem around us and through our bodies. And the thing to restrain initially is this habitual impulsive response. This is the basic renunciation that we do in meditation, is we insist on sitting still, even though we don't want to. And that it's true on all levels. You know, I insist on staying with the breath, even though I just want to think about this thing that my partner said and this thing that my relationship is doing, that my work is doing. And I want to squirm physically, emotionally, mentally. And I teach myself not to. And I do that not because that's how we should live, and not because that's how we should be in a relationship. It's because it's how we see more clearly. And so it's very specifically a meditative hack. You know, much like saying, if you want to take a good, you know, if you want to take a good nature photo, like a good landscape photo, you have to stop the car, put the camera on a tripod, and steady it and focus it. Otherwise, you're not going to get much of a good picture. I got a picture of Stonehenge when we were traveling through England last year. And you know, it's Stonehenge. Like there's crowds, you know, half a mile down from the stones, and there's a humongous parking lot and a museum. And we were just like, we're not going to stop. You know, there's like hundreds of other stone circles that are totally stunning. We're not going to stop at Stonehenge, but you can see it from the road. So I just rolled down the window and I clicked a picture of it with my phone, and that's what I got. You know, if you want a good picture, buy a postcard. Somebody else already took a good picture of it. But, you know, that was the best picture I was going to get from a moving car. And if I wanted my own clear picture, or if even better, if I wanted to really investigate what that place was and felt like, I would have to, you know, stop the car, right? In the book club right now, we just finished reading Digha Nikaya number 2, The Fruits of the Ascetic Life. And one of the participants in the book club had a really beautiful reflection. In it, the tortured king who has killed his father for the kingship and is filled with remorse is going to see the Buddha. And he goes at night, riding on his royal elephants with hundreds of people and guards, and everybody comes with him and all that. And he goes as far as he can go on the elephants, and then he has to get down and walk on foot, and the forest is quiet. He gets scared. It's quiet. He says to his minister who's taking him there, you know, are you leading me into an ambush? This place is too quiet to have hundreds of meditating people. And the minister says, no, the Blessed One and his followers, they love silence. They're right here in the hall meditating. And this person in the book club said, we were talking about, like, you know, the king is this tortured soul. And we were talking about the various interventions that he encounters, how the Buddha is leading him toward some amount of healing in this discourse. And she said, you know, the first intervention is that you have to get off your elephant. And I thought it was so beautifully said, that, like, before anything, before any true contact can happen or true healing can happen, the king has to get down off the royal elephant and walk on foot through the quiet woods. And there's this way in meditation that I think, you know, before we can do any more subtle or complex, you know, philosophical work or healing work or nervous system work, we have to stop whatever we're doing before, right? You have to, you know, close your email, turn off the car, you know, turn off the stove, turn off the television, put the kids to bed, like whatever you got to do, you have to sort of stop in order to come to Sangha, to come to meditate, to sit down. And in that way, the very beginning of the path is actually a fractal of the very end of the path. And the third noble truth says that cessation, the stopping of dukkha, is possible. And the stopping of dukkha consists of the stopping of clinging. Stopping is the training. And so in meditation, we come and we stop, or we invite ourselves to stop. And you know, the thing that's so apparent in meditation for quite a long time for most of us is that you can tell yourself to stop, but the train of the mind just hurdles on forward. You come to sit in meditation, my body is ostensibly still, but the mind, whoa, baby, it just goes. And inviting it to stop and see change more clearly and more microscopically and more viscerally, feel it more viscerally, is a process. You know, it's you know, I feel this with my 7-year-old. Sometimes like at dinner, you know, sometimes we're just like sit down and eat a few bites and you know, and sometimes he totally can, and he just, you know, devours his meal and talks coherently about what he did at camp today, and other times, you know, he's a whirling dervish and he just like bounces in and out of his seat and runs in the room, runs out and eats a bite and can't stop talking even though his mouth is full, and you know, and sometimes, you know, his poor old meditator dad, you know, just wants to be like, stop already, you know, and if he could, you know, his response would be something like, I can't, you know, which is clearly true. And it's up, you know, and we provide the conditions for stopping. When we're successful at that, you know, his system will settle. And, you know, the conditions for stopping for him, you know, are often like deeper connection, and having fulfilled the great requisites of organismic existence, which is, you know, eating, drinking, pooping, and making social contact. So has he done all of those things, right? Have we attained the success in those fundamental realms? And once we have, you know, and then we make contact, then they're settling. And so, you know, we have to take care of material reality. You know, have you eaten? Have you drunk enough water? Do you have to poop? You know, think of yourself as a toddler and take care of the basics. And then, are you well enough? Are you filled up enough with connection? Often the thing that the mind is spinning out around is around ideas around connection, ideas around relationship and people and activities. And am I actually filled up with the sense of being, of belonging, of being connected to people and animals and you know, beings that provide this felt sense of safety? Such that I can actually, like, what are the conditions that support stopping? Such that I can actually stop for a little bit. You know, this is partly why meditation or mindfulness itself, you know, it's not the best intervention for instance, you know, folks who are very traumatized or folks who are really struggling with poverty or material circumstances. It's often a very good kind of third or fourth intervention, But first, you know, you want folks to be fed and clothed and housed and, like, you know, not freaking out. And so once we attend to those layers, it becomes more possible to settle. And so our meditative path is what we can do once the, you know, the basics are there, right? The bottom level of Maslow's pyramid has to be there. Maybe a couple of levels, really. And then you arrive in meditation. You still the body. Stilling the body will reveal the impulses that come out as movement. So that's kind of that's for many folks a first layer. And folks will struggle with this, especially if there's physical pain, but also just long patterns of restlessness in the body or dullness in the body. We want to find the energy in the body stable and settled and comfortable enough that we can come into physical stillness. Physical stillness isn't just a platform for the work of the mind in meditation. It is itself an inquiry practice. It's an insight practice, which is why it's really the whole first layer of the foundations of mindfulness is working with the body. You bring the body into stillness, and then what you can see is all of the ways that impulse responds to the environment, including thoughts and feelings, as with impulses toward movement, right? It responds towards self-protective movements. It responds with fidgeting. It responds with trying to stay comfortable in microscopic ways. So that's a whole layer in meditation to understand how we are activated. This is movement is really fight and flight impulses, right? And so you're noticing how activation is mobilizing the body. And you see if you can let those impulses go by without acting on them. In doing so, you'll start to understand how clinging is playing out as physical movement. And then we do the same thing with the realm of thoughts and feelings. So whatever amount of concentration or steadiness, focus we can develop, it consists in bringing the attention toward a kind of stability. Either stability where we're really attending to one thing, like the breath or the posture or sounds, or we're attending to one way of looking, like we're resting in open awareness, but conscious awareness is staying the stable focus. Whichever way we're doing it, whether it's stable object or stable subject, we are stabilizing this thing that in the untrained mind is never really still. The mind is always jumping from one thing to the next, one thought, one feeling. And again, all these are reactions to other thoughts and feelings, but also to the sensory world. And so the practice in meditation then becomes to not give in to the habit of constantly playing out the mental emotional reaction to things, and instead stabilizing as best we can, right? As much stability as you can find is helpful. And then what you'll see again is the ceaseless push of clinging and craving. You see constantly the way that the mind would rather think about this anxious thing than stay with the breath. The mind would rather obsess about this thing than be with the body. The mind would rather tell a story or complain or fantasize or just wander in aimless confusion. Energy is hard to corral. We see all the ways that impulse is disorganized and or outside of volition. And the only way to really see that is if stillness is established. If we establish stillness by clenching, then what we'll see is that the impulse of clenching. And so the stillness that is ends up being called samadhi or samatha, steady focus, steadiness of heart mind, is really a stillness that's found not by clenching, but by relaxing. It's like, can you relax a limb so deeply that even when the impulse to do something with it comes through, you can let it pass through without acting on it? You can't really do that if you're holding the limb still, it will vibrate too much. So you have to relax it. And then, there's an impulse to lift the arm, but I'm just going to let that impulse pass by without grasping onto it. And so then I start to learn about how constant change and impulse is, because I'm still enough to notice it. And I begin to notice it in a very microscopic way. For me, the feeling is a little bit like I get still enough to notice that the whole space around me, which includes the body and the mind, but really everything surrounding, or not even surrounding, but everything perceptible to my awareness is vibrating, right? There's like sensation and impulse kind of pressing and flowing and hurtling around in all directions. And all of the feelings are stirred and thought is stirred and the body is vibrating. Everything is moving. And so I can perceive that. And to just know that, to be able to see that clearly, requires stepping out of it for a moment. Because if I'm in it in any way, I can't see the part that I'm in. So if I'm active, it's hard to observe my own activity while I'm in it. So I get as still as I can, and I can observe how my impulses are also vibrating. And the insight that comes as this really becomes a place where I can hang out. I need to hang out and see that actually for a while. Part of why longer retreat is often so helpful is that just getting a glimpse of that vibratingness sometimes can be kind of trippy and dramatic and insightful, but really hanging out with it for a while is investigative. Is this really how it is? Are some things more stable than others? What about this state I'm in itself? Is awareness stable and permanent? Is consciousness stable and permanent? Is there a self here observing this whole thing? Oh, that's fluctuating too. You have to hang out in stillness for a while before you can see how much even the one who's observing is subject to vibration in this way. And that when I see that, the insight can come that is the phrase in the classical text is everything that has the conditions to arise has the conditions to pass away. So everything that appears will disappear. That everything is marked by impermanence. And that's the foundational recognition then that opens into understanding clinging, understanding what I can do that shifts my relationship to experience in the direction of more liberation, more freedom, more choice, right? Because the main thing that's happening with all of this being subject to impulses is that I'm not really choosing. I'm not choosing my states. I'm not really choosing my actions very skillfully. I'm kind of awash in impulses, and I do the best I can trying to choose good ones to act on. From a place of deeper stillness, I have far more choice available to me around which impulses to follow. And so the natural result of seeing impermanence in this way, seeing vibration in this way, is a deepening of my skill and ability to manifest ethics, to manifest wise action, to manifest compassionate action, to be engaged in the world in a way that I choose to, rather than as a habitual or addictive pattern. All right, pausing there for the moment. Blessings, thanks for listening. That perceiving that vibration in the Buddhist world leads to the insight into impermanence. If you change channels over into the Shaiva Tantra world, it's called Spanda, and it's the vibratory nature of the universe and of the goddess revealing and concealing herself and creating the universe on the fabric of her own body, always vibrating in and out of existence. So it's that too.